Thanks for that terrific introduction. I think I'll speak from down here. I'm not quite sure how Paul juggled the slide projector changer, the laser pointer, and the microphone with only two hands. But if he can do it, so can I. Anyhow, I am happy to be here and have a chance to talk with you about some of the research that I and my students and collaborators have been doing that relate to this whole repressed memory controversy. And I am going to say a few other things on related topics, but I would like to spend much of the time that I have with you talking about the new research that I and my collaborator, Dr. Giuliana Mazzoni from the University of Florence, although she has recently moved to take an academic position here in this country at Seton Hall University. We've been doing experiments on dream interpretation and the ability of therapists who used suggestive dream interpretation to get people to believe that they had experiences as children. And I think that in looking at the process by which this method of suggestion works in these experiments, and appreciating the fact that I think we have come as close as possible to creating an analog for the psychotherapy that has led many of the people that we care about into this horrible situation, maybe we can learn something from this that will allow us to know how to get people out of this set of beliefs and out of the set of newly acquired false memories that they now have. And I think in listening to Paul this morning and the wonderful retractors that we heard also this morning talk about the process that they went through to shed the memories, or Paul talking about maybe we ought to step up the pressure, and Gail being a little concerned that, we not try to inject a process that just redoes again what was already done to them. Maybe some other ideas will emerge if we all think about what these experiments show and how the methodology of the experiments and the findings of these experiments could be perhaps modified in the service of facilitating this retractor process. It's kind of a new thought about this work that really just has occurred to me in interacting with all of you over the last day or so. Okay, I had a problem that was similar to the problem that Paul had. I don't know how you did it, Paul. But, you know, I thought I was giving a talk to two different groups. And so I thought I could give the same talk. And because I thought it would be the professionals and maybe I would emphasize the methodology or the statistics or whatever a little bit more, but essentially give the same talk to the families here today. I didn't realize that so many of you would be attending the medical college conference. And so it's a little odd to be giving a talk where you are, you know, showing some 30 or 40 people the same slides, and others of you are kind of seeing them for the first time. Fortunately, so here was the slide where I was talking about the legal situation, and using this to talk to some extent about the tolling of the statute of limitations, which has resulted in many individuals being forced to undergo civil litigation as they are being sued based on repressed memory accusations. I hate showing you the same slides over and over, but fortunately someone left a slide in there from another talk. So now let me tell you about the statute of limitations. Just ignore the SBC, although the stock is doing very well right now. But I guess I should disclose that I own it, so if you... it's only fair, yeah. It really is a good stock with a good dividend. And but mostly look at the United States. You know that especially if you were there yesterday, that in 1989, the state of Washington, where I live, became the first state to enact legislation that told the statute of limitations and allowed people to sue their parents, their other relatives, their former neighbors, their former step-parents, their former teachers, their former anybody, if they claimed they repressed the memories and now the memories have come back. We have seen God knows how many of these cases. I mean, you remember when the FMS was tracking these cases and we had the number like 800 known cases. Well, that was about 4 years ago. I don't even know what the number, or maybe 6 years ago, what the number would be today. I still think, I like hearing Paul's optimism about how far we've come. And I do think that one point that was made yesterday is we can concentrate on whether the glass is half full or half empty. But I do want to remind you, because we all have little bits of information that we collect from the part of this controversial world that we interact in, that the problem still exists today. We do still have people being prosecuted for these repressed memory crimes. We only recently saw a horrifying development in California where now, if you live in California, they've just told the statute of limitations for criminal prosecutions for claims of repressed memory of sexual abuse. And so you can be sure that there will be some criminal prosecutions, just as there have now been 10 years of civil cases in California. Of course, Canada and the Canadian group here has already lived with the idea that there is no statute of limitations for criminal prosecutions in sex cases. So they've been experiencing criminal prosecutions for an awful long time. And of course, some of you in this room know that when the girl or woman recovers memories and she's still young enough that the criminal statute of limitations hasn't run, there are criminal prosecutions in this country that have been going on. How many more will there be in California after this new legislation? I guess I'm just telling you this because I don't want us to get complacent. I don't think we can kind of walk away from this problem. I love Pam like we all do, but I disagree that this ought to be the last conference, because there's going to be a need for another conference. And so just to get you a little bit more worried about, some things we do still have to pay attention to, you know that you make a better sword, they're going to make a better shield. And so you make a better sword, and then there's a better shield. So we're getting better at defending these cases, but they're getting better at bringing these cases. It's on account of the fact that some of us stood up and said, wait a minute, childhood amnesia. When they started producing those memories, for events that occurred at age 6 months, or especially the fallopian tube memories and so on, we at least had some research that allowed us to know. And the whole childhood amnesia phenomenon, well established in cognitive psychology, that those memories we could almost certainly declare were false. So what's the response? The therapists aren't producing memories for things that occurred before about age 3 at such a rapid rate. People aren't coming up with memories for things that happen at 6 months old. They've learned, if they want to have any kind of credibility, to lop it off and not start the memories until about age 3. And I'll tell you another horrifying thing. I just testified in a case in Alaska. It was a case brought by a woman against her grandfather. The jury awarded $800,000. I'd bet my house no abuse happened in that case by that grandfather. So how was this jury persuaded in this day and age? They did something very, sadly, I guess you could put it, clever. It's that better sword and that better shield and the better sword and the better shield. They sued two grandfathers. One of them was terrified about this all and settled out for a nominal sum like $10,000, which was far less than the legal fees that he would have had to pay. And this got construed as a kind of a confession and a settlement and an admission of guilt in a lawsuit. And it added credibility to her claim against the other grandfather. You get what I'm talking about. So we're basically going to be fighting a somewhat more sophisticated challenge here, because just as we've gotten smarter, and smarter isn't quite the right word, they too have gotten their swords sharpened a little more. We've come a long way from say 10 years ago or so, when we're trying to figure out what's going on in this therapy. When I first gave that talk in 1992 that Adrienne was referring to the American Psychological Association, and was talking in the very beginning about the questionable therapeutic practices, I was having to base a lot of my knowledge on indirect means of understanding what is going on in this psychotherapy. And so I, along with lots of other people, were analyzing therapists' accounts and patient retrospective reports about what they had gone through to acquire these memories. I relied on some of that, those sort of wonderful data collected by some people in this room who will know who they are, and others where private investigators went into therapists' offices posing as patients and secretly tape recording everything that was said. And it was from those kind of data that we found out that there was first session diagnoses or third session diagnoses of incest survivor, despite the fact that these patients were denying everything happened, that anything like that had happened. It's been a while since we've been criticizing the Courage to Heal, and the questionable quotes from the Courage to Heal and other books like it, like Secret Survivors, and you remember that famous Incest Survivors After Effects Checklist, where if you had trust issues, like you trusted too much or too little, that meant abuse. You had substance abuse issues, if you drank too much or if you were totally abstinent, that meant abuse. If you had gastrointestinal problems or gynecological disorders, that meant abuse. And if you wore a lot of baggy clothing in the summer, that's the one that really got to Carol Tavris when she reviewed this collection of books for the New York Times Book Review right at the beginning of the last decade. But we still have problems. Oh, we've learned a lot now. We don't have to go to those indirect sources. We've learned a lot from the therapy tapes. I mean, in fact, this is one I think of the great, I hate to put it this way, but the retractors' contributions, especially when they came out of that process and they had some tapes of therapy that they were willing to share and willing to make available to us so we could see for ourselves what was going on in some of this questionable therapy. We began to see surveys like the one that was published in 1995, I believe it was, by Poole, Lindsay, Memon, and Bull, that looked at surveys of practicing mental health professionals to try to get a sense of how many of them, what percent were claiming to use and using and favoring the use of different techniques. And we learned from those surveys that hypnosis and age regression and dream interpretation, guided imagery, instructions to give free rein to the imagination were techniques that many therapists were claiming that they used or they favored the use of these techniques, even if there were also corresponding mental health professionals who were disfavoring the use. There have been many more of these studies now. And one of the interesting things about one that's more recent than the Poole study, this one by Pulusny and Follett from the University of Nevada, if you ask these therapists, do you do recovered memory therapy? They all say, no way, I wouldn't. But if you ask them, well, do you ever use hypnosis to try to dig out buried memories? Oh, yeah, I do that. And do you ever use guided imagery? And do you ever sometimes interpret dreams to have sort of sexualized implications? They will admit to some of these individual techniques, but they'll vehemently deny that they do recovered memory therapy or that they are recovered memory therapists. So we've learned that you got to ask the question in a way that gets them to admit what they're really doing. Otherwise, they're going to deny it. Well, what else did I want to tell you about that? The problem is not over. There's an article. I'm not sure how many people Pam gave this article to, but a 1999 article by a therapist named Bull, and it's called A Verified Case of Recovered Memory. And it's, you know, one of these case descriptions, like so many of them, where the therapist who is writing the case report insists it's a real patient with a real recovered memory and that there's really corroboration. And I can tell you that unless you can really get in there and get the data that they won't hand over, we ought to be very, very suspicious of these reports. So what's happened in the memory distortion area? In the memory distortion area, you know, I came to this problem with a long history of being involved in research that attempted to distort people's memories deliberately. I've been doing such studies for at least 25 years, probably distorted the memories of over 20,000 individuals in some, you know, 200 or so published experiments, and I'm just one researcher. So many other people using these same paradigms have done something similar. We did the Lost in the Mall study because what we were looking for was a way of trying to see if, with a fairly strong form of suggestion, you could get people to believe and report and elaborate on completely false or completely planted childhood memories, things that had never happened. And as if you were there yesterday or you read the paper, or there is a brief description of it in one of the papers that's included in your handout, a paper I published in Scientific American a few years ago, then you know that about a quarter of our sample of subjects bought into all or part of this planted suggestion. Numerous other people, other investigators, have adopted a similar procedure. They've gotten information from relatives, they've fed false information to subjects, and they've gotten subjects to believe and report that they were hospitalized with a painful ear infection, that they were involved in an accident at a family wedding, that they were victims of serious animal attacks, that they were victims of serious outdoor accidents or indoor accidents, all with a suggestion that we've heard this from your parent or your older sibling, and we know that this happened to you. Can you tell us what you remember about it? Some of these studies have been done with children, and this was a kind of an interesting development. Steve Ceci from Cornell and Maggie Brock from McGill, but now at Johns Hopkins, and our collaborators, we did suggest to children ages 3 through 6 that they had some experiences that they didn't have. It'd be unlikely that they had had them, like getting your hand caught in a mouse trap and having to go to a hospital to get it removed. And yet a significant minority of these children bought into this false suggestion and would elaborate upon it. One of the subjects in one of these studies actually was interviewed for one of the news magazine programs, and was asked, or actually the tape was shown on this news magazine program, was asked, well, you know, where was the mouse trap that you got your hand stuck in? Oh, it was down in the basement. Well, where in the basement? Right by the woodpile. I mean, they will just elaborate way beyond the germ of information that was used to initiate this false memory. Well, what was the result of this kind of work in the field of psychology? One day, what crosses my desk is a paper that's been submitted to one of our fairly prominent journals, Applied Cognitive Psychology, where a lot of this research gets published. And in this paper, the authors were suggesting that all memory implantation research with children be banned. And the last line of the paper was something like, why should we sacrifice and harm these children who are part of these studies in order to save a few people who claim that they're falsely accused? And I got so furious, but it turns out they removed that line from the paper. There's nothing in there about the falsely accused, but there's actually a paper in Applied Cognitive Psychology that says that this work ought to be banned. So, you know, we got a big problem in the field of psychology. Somebody chose to write that article. Somebody chose to publish that article, and I'm sure the article is being celebrated in many different circles. Never mind the thousands and thousands of children, and this was, of course, part of our reply to this attack, the thousands of children who have undergone these kinds of procedures and never once has there been any evidence of any harm to one of them. In fact, I remember the first individual who received a suggestion about getting lost in a mall was a 14-year-old named Chris, who received that suggestion from his older brother. And when I went back to Chris some many months later, it'd been months since he'd been through this process, and said, how are you feeling about this? Do you have any concerns about it? Do you have any questions you want to ask about it? He said, did you hate it? Did you love it? Whatever. He said, well, he really liked being in that, in as part of that process, because it was so much fun. In fact, he had such a good time that he's tried it out on several of his friends. So I don't know what our research committees are going to think about that. Well, there have been a number of studies that have been done to try to press the limits of the false memory creation problem. And one of them that I just can't resist telling you about, so I can show this photograph that was taken by Fred. Fred's wife. It's a photograph of a little kid, you know, looking at a mobile. And it was used in the Scientific American article and just coincidentally selected to accompany the article that I published in 1997. They just happened to pick a photograph from their archives that was taken by Fred's wife. But in any event, why am I showing you this? Because one of the lines of research that we've been involved in, but the idea came originally from Nick Spanos, the unfortunately deceased psychologist from Canada, who did much great work in the area of hypnosis and memory distortion. He had the idea, and one of his graduate students came to work in my lab, and we kind of modified his basic idea and repeated it. But what this study is about is getting people to believe something that everyone would agree has to be false, or virtually everyone, like planting a memory for watching a colorful mobile hanging over your crib the day after you were born. Now, how are we going to make people believe that? If we succeed, then I think we're in good territory here, because we know that people can't remember things from the day after they were born. At least most of us agree with that, not all of us. Not those, you know, prenatal memory people, but at least most of us. Well, the way we accomplished this is to basically give people a test, some sort of a test battery. It doesn't even matter what the test is. And afterwards, we're going to give them some false feedback. We're going to tell them, your performance was so extraordinary. You are what we call a high perceptual cognitive monitor. You have enormously sophisticated hand-eye coordination. That's the And we have reason to believe, when were you born, 1963? Well, you know, right in that period of time, there were hospitals in place that had a special program designed to increase the hand-eye coordination of infants by exposing them to colorful mobiles dangling over their cribs while they were there in the hospital. And we wonder if anything like that happened to you, because maybe that would explain your very, very excellent performance on these tests. And we age regress them back to the day after they were born and try to get them to remember these mobiles. Now, when Sue Dubray, who had gotten her PhD with Nick Spanos and came to work in my lab as a postdoc, first came with this idea, I said, no, wait a minute, you know, you're telling me that up there in Canada, they're getting people to believe that they experience things? Now, Spanos was using hypnosis, but in some of his conditions, he didn't have hypnosis. And getting people to believe they can have these vivid, detailed memories for things that happened the day after they were born, you know, maybe in Canada, but here? I mean, so I insisted that we include this condition where we try a similar kind of thing, but we try to get people to believe, you know, something after the offset of childhood amnesia. Try to get people to believe that when they were in kindergarten, we didn't want to use mobiles because there really are mobiles hanging in some kindergartens. So we just changed the item to a spiral disc that in your kindergarten class, same cover story, you're taking the test, your hand-eye coordination is so superb, we think you're a high perceptual cognitive monitor, we think you may have been born in a hospital that had a program in place to gone to a kindergarten that had a program in place that hung spiral discs all over the walls to increase this hand-eye coordination, so that kind of a thing. And that we had a method, this age regression method, that was going to get them back to that period, and they would be able to remember. So then we just see kind of what happens. So half of them are going to be regressed back to the day after birth, half to kindergarten. And here's one of our subjects that came out of this process at the University of Washington, who got the false feedback in the mobile or infant condition. She says, the thing that keeps going through my mind is where my sister is, and there's crying a lot, and there's a window like in the second row. It seems as if I were to look straight ahead. There's a big glass window, but only my dad is standing there. And actually, I remember there's a mobile. If I'm lying like this, it's hanging from the left corner, but it seems to be pastel colors. It's nothing bright. Now, this is kind of an interesting response, because notice that she is buying into the suggestion, but she's not accepting it wholesale. She's not getting into this brightly colored thing. She's resisting a little bit. Hers is going to be pastel colors, not the colors that we suggested to her. And I often see that in some of the cases where the therapists try to point out that this is not a patient who is, you know, uncritically accepting all suggestions, because you can find some little spot here where they resisted something and made it pastel instead of bright colors. But in any event, in terms of the data, from this particular study, that we basically found, to make a long story short, that over 60% of our subjects bought into this mobile and claimed to be remembering it and to be able to give some sort of a description of it. Interestingly, only a quarter or so bought into the story about the spiral discs in the kindergarten. And I can say more about why we think we got these results a little later, but I do think that we, using that procedure of Spanos, and fortunately some of his former students recently resurrected all that work, and they've just published this a few months ago in the journal Applied Cognitive Psychology, they do demonstrate that you can create something that is not only very, very, very unlikely to be a real memory, but where is the critical judgment on the part of these people? They're so easy and willing to accept this whole false theory of memory, and that the age regression technique is going to be able to take them back to the day after birth and to run with that theory and respond indicating that they have accepted it. Well, that brings me then to the almost to the dream interpretation studies. And, you know, you can find a lot of discussion of dream work and a lot of discussion of in therapeutic writings and teachings that suggest the belief that dream material is an indication that things happen to you in early life. And so here Renee Fredrickson is talking about repressed memories often surface through our dreams. I mean, I have seen writings of mental health professionals that basically say that if you dream you were attacked, how many people have ever dreamt they were being attacked? I mean, that was a recurrent dream for me. Well, it means you were sexually abused. I mean, according to, you know, some psychotherapeutic lore, and I already talked about how the snake means a penis and the cinnamon roll means a penis and being chased, you know, means a penis. And so they can relate it back to sex abuse, no matter, you know, what the dream material is. There's some way to make that connection. So Juliana Mazzoni, you know, and the way our work got conceived, it's all very serendipitous. Dr. Mazzoni was a young female Italian academic at the University of Florence, and as is the case at some institutions generally outside of this country, she worked in a lab where you kind of had to do the work that was of interest to the chief in the lab. So her boss was interested in sleep and dreams, but Juliana was interested in memory and memory distortion. And so she needed to be doing some work that somehow related to sleep and dreams in order to get permission from the boss to do that. And so sitting around with her, we began to think that maybe there was a way to combine the idea of sleep and dreams that she had to do with the idea of memory distortion, which is what we were really interested in. And so we began a program of research where we started looking at under what conditions people's dream material can be twisted so that you start to believe that you actually experience those events, not just dream them. And so we have kind of several years of work along that line. And this particular line of studies that we've just recently published, and we'll soon publish a few more of them, comes out of that kind of convoluted interest. So here's what happened. I think I'm going to skip over the imagination inflation studies and just go straight to the dream thing, and I think I'll be able to bring you up to date, those of you who weren't here yesterday. When you do something like, you know, Lost in the Mall, you know, with college students, or when you do something like the imagination studies where you just get people to imagine that they had an experience that they've previously denied having, and you see some elevated confidence that they had these experiences in childhood, there was always the criticism coming back that, well, the event wasn't very traumatic, or the maybe the event really did happen. Maybe they really were lost in the mall, and all you've done is tap into a real memory. And they came up with all kinds of other potential criticisms so as to not deal with the idea that we were showing autobiographical memory distortions and that they were relatively easy to produce. So we wanted a study that looked a little bit more like you might see in a psychotherapy setting. We wanted a study that removed the demand characteristics, so we removed the ability of our critics to say people are just telling you what they think you want to hear. So we're going to make it really, really hard in this study for people to figure out what it is that we really want to hear, so they can't just be responsive to, you know, wanting to give an answer that will please the experimenter, that kind of thing. also, we wanted to design some studies where if we produced a false memory, or if we produced a memory, we could have more assurance that it was probably false. And so we decided that what we would try to do is get people to believe that they were lost in a big public place before the age of three for an extended period of time, and that they were frightened, that they felt abandoned by their parents, they felt lonely and lost in this unfamiliar place. How did we do it? Well, first of all, you do have to keep track of which is which here. You can't do the slide projector when you mean the laser, because otherwise bad things happen. this study is disguised in a way that, although it is one study from our point of view, these subjects believe that they are participating in two separate studies, and they're very well disguised from each other. By the way, this first study, in fact, I'm going to tell you about three studies today. The first two were done in Italy at the University of Florence, and the third one was done with American subjects at the University of Washington, and I'll tell you a little bit about what we learned in doing that third study. So here we are. These subjects come in. They believe that they're participating in an early memory experiment. They fill out a life events inventory. It's just a list of items that could have happened to you before the age of three. And you just say on a scale from 1 to 8, definitely didn't happen to definitely did happen. Got lost in a public place. Shook hands with the president. Got in trouble for calling 911. That kind of thing. And it either definitely didn't happen or it definitely did happen or anything in between. Now, 3 to 4 weeks later, you're going to take that same LEI, fill it out again, tell us about your childhood again. Unbeknownst to these subjects, half of them are lured to participate in what they think is a totally separate experiment. It's got a separate location, it's got a separate experimenter, it's got a separate consent form, it's got a separate debriefing, and it is seemingly unconnected to anything else they've done. And when they are now signed up for the sleep and dream experiment, their job is to go in to Dr. Lombardo's office with a dream report. When they go into Dr. Lombardo, by the way, he is, as I said yesterday, the Dr. Laura of Florence. He doesn't have her same conservative views on various subjects, although she's good on the topic of repressed memory. She's got a few problems with some of her other topics. But Dr. Lombardo is the radio psychologist in Florence. He's very well known. He's very charismatic. He's articulate. He's had a private practice, and so he's an experienced clinician. And he is our collaborator in this research. And when these individuals come into him with the dream report, he fills them in about how he's one of the world experts in dreams and what dreams mean, and dreams do tap into early experiences in life. And he says that, let's look at your dream report. And it doesn't matter what the subject has dreamed. It can be, I dreamed I was at a bowling alley and I just wasn't able to get anything right. Or it can be, I dreamed I was, you know, walking up a mountainside alone. And the subject then talks a little bit about what she thinks the dream means. And then Dr. Lombardo says, well, you know, I have had a tremendous amount of experience, and in my experience, this dream means something specific. It indicates to me, Dr. Lombardo, that you were lost in a big public place somewhere before the age of three. Usually this is the kind of experience that leads to a dream like this. That you felt abandoned by your parents, that you felt lonely and lost in this unfamiliar place. And they discussed the dream some more, and just to finish this off, Dr. Lombardo says, you know, I do want to tell you that the last patient that I had who had a dream like yours remembered, you know, being in a bowling alley and not being able to get anything right. It turned out she had been lost, she found out later, in the Piazza del something or other for an extended period of time. But ultimately, her family found her. The subject says thanks very much and walks out of Dr. Lombardo's office and is lured then to participate back to complete the final part of that seemingly separate first experiment. So it's 1 to 2 weeks after having seen Dr. Lombardo that the subject comes back and fills out the LEI again. And here's what happened. Some of you have seen these data already, but I'm going to need to show them to you and then work up to the final experiment and give you a few little anecdotes about some of the things that happened in this study that were unexpected and that you will never hear about anywhere else except here. First of all, if you look at the white bars, and they tell you that when people fill out that LEI, they tell you, you know, how likely is it before the age of three you were felt abandoned by your parents or you were lost in a public place before the age of three. If they have not gotten the dream interpretation, some of them went up, some went down, nothing systematic is happening, that's reflected in those white bars. But look what happened here, looking at the blue bars, after a single half hour with Dr. Lombardo. After a single half hour with Dr. Lombardo, 89% of those subjects increased their confidence that they got lost in a public place. And if you just focus your attention on the rightmost bar, you see there 58%. 58% increased their confidence after a half hour with Dr. Lombardo that they felt abandoned by their parents. And that last critical item embedded in the LEI, you can see here 79% increased their confidence that before the age of three, they found themselves lonely and lost in an unfamiliar place, increasing their confidence. The mean increases are quite a bit more pronounced than the increases we got in the imagination study. A single act of imagination of a counterfactual led to relatively small increases and relatively few percentages of people increasing their confidence. But here you can see by looking at the rightmost dark bar that the mean increase in confidence is about 2.25 points on that 8-point scale. Now I can tell you a lot more, about what we've learned here. These suggestions are very specific to the kind of thing being suggested. You know, as scientists, we will often ask a question about our data, and then we look for evidence that will either confirm or disconfirm the hypothesis we're raising. So we did raise the hypothesis, maybe what we're doing here, maybe Dr. Lombardo is just making these people feel generally negative about their lives, and maybe we would see these increases in confidence that you had a generally negative experience, like the death of a pet or seeing an accident or something like that. Turns out, no evidence for that. It's not a general negativity. It's just very specific to the critical events that were being suggested by Dr. Lombardo. Well, the second thing we did then is to say, wow, you know, we got lots of people increasing their confidence. We've certainly affected their feelings about their childhood. But what really, we need to replicate this. It was such a strong effect, and we wanted to see if we could get it again. And when you do a replication, generally what you're doing is not only replicating the finding, if you can, but sometimes you add a new twist to the study so that you can, at the same time that you're replicating, you can also learn something new and additional and expand your knowledge about the phenomenon that you're interested in. And so what we did here is to not only replicate and tell half of our people, Dr. Lombardo telling half of them that what their dream means is that they were lost in a big public place, that they were abandoned by their parents, whatever, but we decided to see if this would work for a different set of items, and so half of our subjects got their dream interpreted by Dr. Lombardo, no matter what they dreamed, to mean that before the age of three, they faced some great danger, they faced some threat to their lives, they were rescued from a dangerous situation. Now, all these subjects then get lured back to participate in the second half of that first experiment, and that is not 1 to 2 weeks later, but in order to address the question of how long is Dr. Lombardo's influence going to last, I mean, how long are we going to see the effects of having spent a half hour with Dr. Lombardo? We decided to stretch out this time interval to a full month. So 4 weeks after having visited Dr. Lombardo and having had that dream interpretation manipulation that lasted for a half hour, these subjects come back and fill out the LEI again. And here's what happened. If you look at that rightmost bar, you're supposed to gasp. These are very impressive data that you can, spend a half hour with some total stranger who gives you this, shinola about how dreams can reveal your early experiences in life, and you will go in there and tell some complete stranger a month later that, yes, you're more confident. 100% every one of these people was more confident that before the age of 3 they got lost in a public place. 75% more confident that they felt abandoned by their parents before the age of 3. And that rightmost bar, 82% increased confidence that they felt lonely and lost in this unfamiliar place. 1 month after a half hour with Dr. Lombardo. So actually, Paul, those therapists that are taking 6 weeks, they're not very good. They're not as good as Dr. Lombardo. And the danger set, same thing. 68% increased confidence that they faced a great danger before the age of 3. That they had a threat to their lives at 66%, I think that is. And finally, 51% saying they were rescued from danger before the age of 3. I've often found it sort of peculiar that fewer were rescued than faced it, but and yet they're here to participate in the study today. But that just shows you that not everybody is logical in thinking about their past. The mean increases, you can't really read these numbers, but they're even a bit stronger than we saw in the other study. Averaging across the lost set of items and the danger set of items, you find a mean increase of 3 points on that 8-point scale. Lots of people are going from didn't happen to did happen. Well, now let me tell you about the last study of the recently published studies in this series. We have done one more that we have not yet published. But what is it that's been done to these people? You know, when they walk out of Dr. Lombardo's office, they aren't saying, oh gosh, I now have this great big vivid memory. I was in the piazza whatever in Venice and this happened to me. They walk out of his office and they are saying, that makes a lot of sense, but I don't really have any memory. And then 2 weeks later in one study, 4 weeks later in the other study, they show up to fill out the LEI again and they have this increased confidence. What is it that they have? Do they just have a belief that this experience happened to them, or do they have kind of a full-blown memory? Like our Lost in the Mall people had, where the guy's saying, I remember the guy who rescued me at a bald spot and he had a plaid shirt. And I mean, what is it that they have in their minds and when did they get it? We never probed them very far to find out what it was they had in their minds. So one of the things we wanted to do in this last study is after they came back and filled out the LEI again for the second time, and showed that their confidence was increased, we wanted to design some questions where we could get in there and say, what is it they have in mind? Is it just a belief, or is it a belief and also some supporting memory? We were also interested in this particular study in extending our results to another critical set of items. And so you can see here that half of our subjects are going to be told that their dream meant they were lost, and the other half are going to be told that before the age of 3, they had a very unpleasant experience being harassed by a bully. And finally, 1.5 to 2 weeks later, they'll return to fill out the LEI again. And here are the data. The loss data look just like they do in the other study. Increased confidence, big mean increases in confidence that you had this experience before the age of 3. So the newer data here are just showing you what happens with that bully item. And you can see there 51% increased their confidence that before the age of 3 they were harassed by a bully. But now, and this was all disguised in a way so that people could not figure out what we were after. Essentially, we said to them, look, we want to ask you about a few of these things that you're claiming you remember. And we picked out some random ones that weren't critical, and then we picked out the critical one, either the lost one or the bully one, depending on what condition they were in. And we said, now, do you have any specific memory of this, or do you just have a belief that this happened to you? And one of the things that we found, as illustrated in this slide right here, is at least in this particular study, these are people who increased in LEI, and we asked them, do you have a memory, or do you basically just have a belief without any memory? And you will see here that 57% of our subjects reported that they actually did have some specific memory to accompany this belief. We still have almost half of them, 43% or whatever it is, who insist that they don't have any specific memory, but they just have a strong belief that this experience happened to them. And we've done some analysis that I'm not going to bore you with, and you're not going to be able to read this, and neither can I, even though I'm standing right here, of the specific kinds of memories that they actually did come up with. These are verbatim quotes from some of the subjects who did develop this increased confidence and a memory to go with it. So what have we shown here? First of all, I forgot to tell you one important thing about this last study. Giuliana Mazzoni was now spending a significant time at the University of Washington. Dr. Lombardo was still back in Florence. We didn't have the money to bring him out for this study, but Giuliana says, well, maybe I'll do some of these dream interpretations, but they're pretty time-consuming. So she didn't have time to do all of them. So we recruited another person to do half of the dream interpretations in the third study. And the person we recruited is a young man named Aaron Seitz. Now, Aaron Seitz had basically just finished school at Reed College, and he was trying to decide, you know, should he go to graduate school, and if so, in what field. And so he was hanging around the University of Washington, and he volunteered to do some research in my lab just to get some experience. And we said, Aaron, how would you like to play the role of Dr. Lombardo and do half of these dream interpretations? In this last study, then, Giuliana did half of them, and Aaron Seitz did half of them. This, you know, not even graduate student who we just taught how to behave like Dr. Lombardo. And both of them were as effective as Dr. Lombardo in producing these results. So you don't even need Dr. Lombardo, is what we learned here, to be able to create this sort of effect. There's one more thing that, you know, a couple of interesting anecdotes. See, these dream interpretations were now going on in an office across the hall from where mine is, where my postdoc office. And Giuliana would do the dream interpretation, and then if something unusual happened, she'd run across the hall to tell me about it. She only ran across the hall twice. The first time she ran across the hall, she had this room, by the way, where she did the dream interpretation. And to make it look a little official, she kept the lights kind of low in the room. And the subject would sit on one chair, and Dr. Mazzoni would sit on the other chair, and so on. So she was beginning the dream interpretation process with one subject. And she was about to do her interpretation that this meant you were lost in a big public place and you felt abandoned by your parents, when the subject moved her arms, which had been behind her back, and put them on her lap, And Juliana could see self-mutilation marks up and down the arms of this subject. So the subject was instantly converted to a control subject on the spot there, and her data were removed from the analysis. That was a pretty unusual experience, but the one that really upset Juliana more even than that one, when she came across the call for the second time during that quarter when she was doing those dream interpretations, it was to tell me about a subject who she had just finished the dream interpretation with, and as the subject was leaving and finishing what she thought was the experiment, but before she had been lured back to complete the LEI several weeks later, this subject said to Juliana, "I want to thank you. I really, really feel I understand myself better." Now, why was that interesting? Well, first of all, it was upsetting for Juliana. I mean, I think it tells us something about this therapist had provided for this experimental subject an explanation of some sort for whatever was maybe bothering her. She bought into this explanation, but from Juliana's point of view, look what was going to happen 2 weeks later. 2 weeks later, that subject was going to go somewhere else, fill out the LEI, and then be debriefed and told, guess what? Your dream didn't mean that at all. We completely made it up. We don't understand you, and you don't understand yourself. So we had to be sure we handled that particular debriefing with extra delicacy. I don't know what to say. You know, to me, these studies, as I say, are as close as we've been able to think of to get an analog to a therapy patient interaction. They show that just 30 minutes with a complete stranger who presents himself or herself as an authority figure. And I do think, you know, that that's one of the reasons why these effects are so powerful. These seem, Paul called them, you know, kind of medical authority. They come in there and they say, "I've looked at your data," the data in this case, just the dream report, and the way the subject discussed the dream initially, that was enough. "I've looked at your data. I've had lots and lots of experience. I'm a big expert in this field, and here's what I think your dream means." And in 1.5 hour, we have affected the autobiographies of these subjects, whether we have just created a belief or whether we've created a belief plus induced them to generate some supporting memory, we have influenced them in a fairly significant way. So, I don't know about this. How can we use this sort of information to think about some of the issues that were raised earlier this morning involving retractors? When Paul suggests maybe we should put more pressure on the retractors, or someone else suggested maybe we need more counter suggestion, that might have also come from Paul. It started me thinking, how do we get pressure? How do we get counter suggestion? How do we create a situation where people feel embarrassed about having these particular beliefs and admitting that they have them, in the same way that they would be, you know, embarrassed if they were still McCarthyites today, or whatever it is that you can think of that might be a better example? I mean, I started thinking of public service television advertisements, since many other areas of our society use these to try to affect public opinion and try to get people to be not doing certain things that are supposedly harmful for them. And then somebody started talking, I guess maybe it was Laura, talking about the use of the internet. We're in the midst of a telecommunications revolution. Let's take advantage of it. And perhaps some of that counter suggestion or that pressure can be put in a place where the people we want to reach are going to find it in as easy a way as possible. Well, I hope that maybe with this study and the power of these techniques, we can think about how we might harness this power and use it for some good use. Thank you very much for listening.